Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to the Vibrant Health Solutions Radio Show. I'm your host,
Dr. Rita Marie Moscalzo, and each week we bring you cutting-edge information about how you can be the healthiest and happiest and most vibrant person you possibly can be. And we're really fond of using cutting-edge information in the realm of nutrition and lifestyle, including diet and exercise and a whole host of other interventions. So I am always thrilled to bring you information, and I love it when we have guests. I don't always have guests, but I do love it when we have guests. And I especially love it when we have extremely special guests like the one we have today. So let me tell you a little bit about our guest today and about our topic. The topic that we have on tap for you today is about gluten and the way gluten affects the brain. And you may be thinking, what? Gluten affecting the brain? I thought gluten was a gut disease. I thought gluten was a disease that caused people to have bloating and gas and diarrhea and just feel crummy in the belly. And you know what? I don't have those symptoms, so why should I listen to you about gluten? Well, the truth of the matter is gluten intolerance can affect just about any part of your body, and especially true of the way it affects the brain. And in fact, when I did a lot of research years ago, I discovered that there were earlier signs in a lot of people, in a vast majority of people actually, was the earliest signs of gluten intolerance actually affected the brain before the gut. But we know how to look for it in the gut because of quote-unquote celiac disease. So let me tell you a little bit about my guest today, my colleague and friend, Dr. Tom O'Brien. Dr. Tom O'Brien has been studying gluten and the effects on human health and behavior for over a decade. He is passionate about finding the information, talking directly to the researchers in this area, interviewing them, speaking about it and spreading the word worldwide about how gluten can affect just about every system in our body, and how, for me and any of you out there who are health practitioners, for our patients, for our clients who are coming to us with a myriad of symptoms that we're not really sure what they are, very often gluten intolerance can be at the heart of it. So I'm so thrilled to have Dr. Tom here today. I've met him personally many times, and he has been a guest speaker at my Shine Live event, which happened last year, and the talk was on the thyroid and the adrenal, and he talked eloquently about the effect of gluten on those systems. This year, our Shine Conference is all about the gut-brain connection, and that's some of what we're going to talk about today, is how gluten affects the brain, and we're going to welcome Dr. O'Brien back to it. So he holds a teaching faculty position with the Institute of Functional Medicine, the National University of Health Science. He's the vice president of the Illinois chapter of the International American Association of Clinical Nutritionists. He's been listed in the Who's Who in International Medicine and International Directory of Distinguished Leadership. I mean, it goes on and on. And he founded the very first and the very only Gluten Summit, which happened, oh my gosh, it's almost 2 years ago. I can't believe it's been that long. And it was a joy to be promoting that summit and having the feedback that I got from the people on my newsletter list who went to that summit and learned so much, and a number of people who I'd been talking to about gluten sensitivity who finally got it, that maybe this was a real thing and they needed to do it. So without further ado, I just want to welcome you, Dr. Tom O'Brien. Hello, Dr. O'Brien.
Oh, Dr. Rita, hello. It's so nice to hear your voice again.
You too. I'm so thrilled that you took time out of your busy schedule to be here with us and to talk about something that we share a passion about, which is helping people to revive and restore their health. And one of the tools we use is a gluten-free diet.
Yes.
So
yes, it's a real pleasure. Thanks.
And you're doing such great work in the world because you're actually reaching people in a way that a lot of other people aren't reaching them. You're presenting them not only the facts, you're presenting the science, you're presenting, I love that you're wiggling fingers and all the other ways that you describe it in ways that can understand it, right, about the gut lining and the effects of gluten on the gut lining. So So I really, really want to get into some things today, and I have a ton of questions I want to ask you, in particular about how it affects the brain. And you may want to just give a little background for those who don't know, just a little bit about gluten and how it affects the gut and how that affects the brain. But I would love to hear that. And also I have a question I'm going to ask you very specifically as we present this about a specific case that we have where we just want to really understand when do people need to go 100% gluten-free and when is mostly gluten-free good enough. So
okay.
Let's just get started. What, you know, tell us a little
all
about
right,
gluten
let me,
and how there's inflammation and all that.
Great, great. So I'll start with the premise for everyone that gluten is not bad for you. Bad gluten is bad for you. And there's gluten in corn. There's gluten in rice. There's gluten in quinoa. There's gluten in buckwheat. There's gluten in wheat and rye and barley. And so gluten is the term for a family of proteins. Unfortunately, because of the popular press, it's become like a buzzword, gluten. And it's really not the right terminology to use. It should be toxic gluten or the toxic family of glutens. But you know what happens? It's like you take a sheet of paper and you hand it to someone and say, would you please Xerox this? Well, wait a minute. Xerox is the name of a company. It's not an action verb, but it's been transitioned into an action verb because of great marketing they did. And the same has happened with the word gluten. We think gluten is really bad for us. No, it's not. But bad gluten is bad for you. And so that's the first thing. So it's a family of proteins. And
so before
you
go any further with that, though, because you've said something that is, it's just kind of struck me and it's going to strike other people, is that I generally, and my understanding is that we generally don't call that protein in rice, and, you know, we always think about rice and corn and those sorts of things as having some proteins that might be similar to gluten, but they're not really the gluten. So you're distinguishing that whole family is really gluten, and what we have to
identify.
Yes.
Yes, yes, and that doesn't come from me. I mean, there's the textbooks on agriculture identify this, that botanists know this, that there are different families, and it's the grass family, I'm not sure I'm going to pronounce this right, the triticae family of grasses, of gluten proteins that include wheat, rye, and barley. That family of grasses and the proteins from them are not digestible by any human. Harvard published a study earlier this year that they looked at people with celiac disease. That's when you have a gluten sensitivity affecting your gut, and that's where most of the research has been done over the last 60 years is on celiac disease. People that had celiac disease but had been on a gluten-free diet for a couple of years. People that had non-celiac gluten sensitivity mean they reacted to gluten, and when they took the gluten out of their diet, when they took wheat out of their diet, their symptoms went away. Those were NCGS, non-celiac gluten sensitive people. And then people that had no problem with gluten that could be identified. So they looked at four groups, and they exposed them all to the gluten proteins of wheat, and what did they find? Every single group activates the genes for intestinal permeability. The slang term is leaky gut when they're exposed to the gluten proteins of wheat. Everyone, it doesn't matter if you have the genes for celiac disease or not, every human gets inflammation in their intestines whenever they're exposed to gluten, every time. But the fastest growing cells in your body are the inside lining of your intestines. We all know this. Every 3 to 7 days, you have a whole new lining to your intestines and a whole new body every 7 years. Some cells rebuild very slowly. Some are very quick. The intestines are the fastest. Every 3 to 7 days, there's a whole new lining to the intestines. So you have a sandwich for breakfast. You tear the lining of your gut. It heals. You have a sandwich or toast. I'm sorry. You have toast for breakfast. You tear the lining. It heals. You have a sandwich for lunch. You tear the lining. It heals. You have pasta for dinner. You tear the lining, it heals. You have a cookie, you tear the lining, it heals. You have a salad with croutons, you tear the lining, but it heals. And then one day, day after week after month after year, until one day, you cross a threshold. Wherever that threshold is for you, depending on your genetics and how you've lived your life, how much mercury and, you know, heavy metal toxicity and toxic chemicals and trauma and all that and stress. Those are called antecedents. So one day you cross this imaginary line, wherever it is, could be at 2 years old, it could be at 20 years old, it could be at 62 years old, and you cross that imaginary line where your body can't put up with, it can't heal from the tears that are occurring from this food, and now you get what's called pathogenic intestinal permeability. Now you got a problem, because now this goes systemic. And now the molecules from any food that you eat can get into your bloodstream before they've been digested thoroughly. If you think of the lining of your intestines lined with cheesecloth, and the purpose of the cheesecloth is not to let, is to prevent big molecules of food from getting through into the bloodstream. It's all got to be broken down by digestive enzymes. That's why you've got 25 feet of intestines, is because it takes a long time to break down some of these foods, but the enzymes are supposed to do a good job of that. So as foods are getting broken down, the easier foods to break down go through the intestine lining first, but then the more difficult foods can't get through the intestinal lining there. They've got to go further down in the intestines and being broke down until they're nice and tiny. The problem is when you get tears in the cheesecloth and you get these big molecules going through before they've been broken down enough, they're called macromolecules, big molecules. They get in the bloodstream and your brain says, wait a minute, this is not something I can use to build new bone cells or new muscle cells. This is not a raw material to build new cells with. I better fight this one. Now you make antibodies to tomatoes or to beef or to chicken or to whatever you're eating. Now you're making antibodies to these macromolecules, and you go into a doctor and you get a blood test done, or for those doctors that are listening, you run a 90-food IgG panel, and the patient comes back allergic to 25 foods. And they say,
one
oh, my
more.
God, that's everything. That's everything I eat. What am I going to eat? Well, of course it's everything you eat, because your immune system's doing exactly what it's supposed to do to try to protect you, because this crud is getting into the bloodstream way before it should be allowed to get into the bloodstream. It hasn't been broken down enough. And that is the main reason why we have so many food sensitivities today, is that we lose tolerance. We cross that imaginary line, and now you've got a problem that's systemic.
Yeah. Wow. So, I'm going to recap a little bit here. So basically what I heard was when, you know, we start out at some point and you're eating gluten and nobody really can digest it, it causes a transient break in the intestinal lining, but we heal it, and we do that again and we heal it. But after a while, and it could be 2 months, it could be 2 years, whatever, we no longer can heal it. And that's when the problem starts. So that's when people, then this is why I want to stop, because people say, well, I've been eating it my whole life. Why am I
suddenly
having a problem with it?
Because you crossed the line. You crossed the line.
Yeah,
and it wasn't intentional on your part or your daughter's part or your mother's part. It wasn't intentional. But, you know, with the BPA, that's the chemical that softens plastic water bottles that you get when you drink out of a plastic bottle, or the mercury that you get when you eat fish, or the lead you get from breathing the air in a house where they paint the paints from before 1978, it's all lead paint, and the lead outgases. You know, you just accumulate all these toxins in a lifetime, and your immune system's fighting all of this stuff until you cross the line, and now the immune system starts reacting to the mild stuff. Gluten is a mild to moderate toxin for most people. It's not a major toxin until you cross the line. And when you cross the line, you got a problem, and it doesn't go away. So I'm going to give you an example. You mentioned something in the introduction about we think of food sensitivities in the gut. Well, the science is really clear. For every one person that has symptoms in their gut from a sensitivity to gluten, there are eight that don't. The ratio is 8 to 1 that it's going to be somewhere else in your body. It's going to be your kidneys or your heart or your brain or your muscles. And the most common system is the brain. That's the most common.
Yep.
So I'm going to give you an example here of a case study, because this one just shocked me. And I used it in my presentation to behavioral optometrists. These are the guys that specialize in looking at your eyes and for people with attention deficit or some type of brain dysfunction. and they give you eye exercises and motion exercises to rewire, if you will, to reboot and rewire how your brain's working. And they get dramatic results sometimes. So I gave a presentation to the National Optometric Rehabilitation Association in Denver a couple of months ago. And these people had never heard of any of this before, so I knew that I had to really get them in the very beginning, or else they'd start drifting and, you know, be thinking about other stuff. So I put a case study in here. This is a 3-year-old girl that had a lesion in the eye. You know, it looked like a bunch of blood vessels that were all pooled together, and it turned out to be a tumor in the eye. It was a conjunctival tumor. That means on the conjunctiva of the eye, right above the pupil, the black part of the eye, and it was big and it was ugly. You see the picture of it in the Medical Journal of Ophthalmology. And it was diagnosed as Kaposi sarcoma. That that's the cancer that comes with HIV. And because the girl's mother was HIV. But they did the blood test on the girl, and it was negative. She didn't have antibodies to HIV. She didn't have HIV. Well, wait a minute. She's got Kaposi sarcoma. Well, wait a minute. Well, let's do a biopsy of this to find out what it is. Well, the parents said no to the biopsy. They wanted to wait because the child had just been diagnosed 2 weeks earlier with celiac disease. That's gluten sensitivity affecting the gut. And they put the child under a general anesthetic to do the endoscopy and biopsy for celiac, because they put a tube down your throat and look at the intestines and all that. So they put her under a general anesthetic. They knocked her out. She had a reaction to the medications of the general anesthetic. And so the parents said, you know, our child needs a little bit of time to recover from the last general that we put her under. We're not going to put her under a general anesthetic so you can do a biopsy of the eye. Let's wait a couple of weeks. So they come back 2 weeks later. The tumor is smaller. The ophthalmologists say, wait a minute, what is this? And they take a picture of it and they show it in the journal. It was a little smaller. They come back 2 weeks later again. It's smaller yet. They come back after 2 months. It's gone. And all they did different was they put the child on a strict gluten-free diet. And so the ophthalmologists, these eye specialists, had never heard of anything like this. And the way they summarized it in their study, they said, in conclusion, I'm reading it now, we present a very unusual conjunctival tumor in a patient with celiac disease that showed complete regression by a gluten-free diet. The precise pathological nature of this conjunctival lesion remains unknown because they didn't do a biopsy. However, prompt regression of the conjunctival lesion during gluten-free diet suggests a possible relationship to celiac disease and an autoimmune process in the eye. So, in this child, it saved her eye, and it saved dramatic surgery that she would have had to have had by just putting her on a gluten-free diet. And that's the way it is with gluten sensitivity. You pull at a chain, and the chain breaks at the weakest link. It's at one end, the middle, the other end. It's your heart, your brain, your liver, your eye, your kidney. Wherever your genetic weak link is, that's where you're going to feel the symptoms when you cross the line and the straw that broke the camel's back. Whenever that occurs in your life, you're going to feel the symptoms eventually, because the tissue gets damaged. Eventually, you'll feel the symptoms wherever the weak link is. That's why in my all-day seminars, and in my training for healthcare practitioners, I have an online training program for all healthcare practitioners, and I think everyone should do it so that you really understand this stuff thoroughly. But in those trainings, I show the medical journal articles reversing ALS, which is a fatal diagnosis. And they show the MRIs of the lesions in the brain that go away within a year on a gluten-free diet, and the man is out of the wheelchair, back to his life again. Reversing psoriasis, terrible, terrible psoriasis, gone in 30 days on a gluten-free diet. Now, this doesn't mean that every psoriasis patient has a gluten sensitivity, but what we know is that 14% of them have celiac disease. That means every psoriasis patient should just be checked to see if they have a sensitivity to gluten. So wherever the weak link is, that's where it's going to manifest. And it can be anywhere in your body. It can be reproductive problems. And I published an article in the Journal of Applied Gastroenterology a few years ago on reproductive disorders in celiac disease, and I quoted 68 studies in that article. So it just depends on where it manifests as to where your weak link is. So you don't know what to look for with this thing, because you can't say, I get stomach pains when I eat. Those that get abdominal pain, stomach pains when they eat pasta, you are so lucky. You are really lucky, because it's obvious. You put something down there and you hurt, it doesn't take rocket science to say, you know, that's probably not good for me.
Exactly. Exactly. No, that's a great, I love the way you pointed that out. And some of these things, I mean, to have a tumor like that regress, people don't expect that. And the thing I look at is, so if you've got any kind of health challenge at all, you've got to look and rule out gluten sensitivity. Because
yes,
it
that's
could be
exactly
anything.
Right.
It could be anywhere. It could be a persistent toenail fungus. It could
exactly
be anything.
Right.
Right, and especially going back to the brain, you know, some of the things that have been linked to it, and I first learned about this from you, you know, probably 12 years ago when I first heard you speak at one of the IAACN conventions, was about Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. And when I heard that,
yes,
that really struck a chord with me. It's like these poor people are going around looking for answers and are losing their memory, and it could be a gluten intolerance, and nobody's telling them to look at that.
Exactly right. And it doesn't mean every one of them have a gluten intolerance. It means that every one of them should be checked for a gluten sensitivity, because it could be the fuel on the fire causing the damage.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I just wanted to put in there, you mentioned in passing your gluten practitioner training, and several of the people in my practitioner training and in our field, in our areas, have gone through your training and they absolutely loved it. So just
I think
what you're doing out there is amazing. Totally amazing, because more practitioners need to know how to detect this. So you keep mentioning being checked for it. So give everybody an idea of how you would check for it.
Well, okay, there's two different things you look for, and the problem for so many people is called the conundrum of gluten sensitivity, that people go to their doctor, they think they may have a problem, doctor does a blood test, nope, you're fine, you don't have a problem with gluten, see, the test is negative. You say, oh, well, okay, I guess it's not that, I guess I'm just stressed. And you go back eating gluten and you feel terrible and you keep killing off brain cells because you think it's just stress. Well, it was the test that was, and then when those people go on a gluten-free diet, they feel better. They say, well, wait a minute, but the blood test was negative. Well, it's the wrong blood test.
Mm-hmm.
And doctors think that they should be looking for celiac disease and doing blood tests for celiac disease. That's not what you should be looking for, unless there's a family history or you suspect that. You, of course, want to include a test for celiac disease, of course, but what you want to look for is gluten sensitivity. And the test for celiac disease doesn't check for gluten sensitivity thoroughly enough. The test for celiac disease looks for celiac disease. And that blood test marker is called transglutaminase. And it's a really good marker as a blood test. But if you tell your doctor you think you have a problem with gluten, he says, well, let's check you for celiac. You need to say, well, I understand it may be celiac, but that's only an 8-to-1 ratio. It may be something else. So how do we check for those other things? Well, we'll check for celiac. Well, but I'm grateful we're going to check for celiac, but how do we check for a gluten sensitivity? And well, this is the test for gluten and for celiac. And some doctors will just blow it off because they don't know what to do. But I've got to differentiate for all of the listeners so that you know. So take some notes here or rewind and listen to this again so that you're clear about how to describe this. When the researchers published their papers on the transglutaminase blood test for celiac disease is 97, 98, 100% accurate, those papers, they're right. They're right on the money with what they wrote. That's true. But what they did in order to be able to research this is they got the blood of people with celiac disease. And there are blood banks where researchers can buy blood of people with MS or with diabetes or with autoimmune thyroid or with celiac. So they buy 100 samples or 200 samples, and it's really expensive, but they buy it, and then they can run their tests to see if the particular marker, in this case transglutaminase, really works or not. And they're 97, 98, 100% accurate, transglutaminase is, for all those blood samples that they got. Here's the problem. In order to get the diagnosis of celiac disease and be in the blood banks, your blood's pooled in there, it's frozen and saved in there. In order to be in that blood bank and labeled as celiac disease, you have to have what's called total villus atrophy. That means that the damage in your intestines is at the end stage. It's really bad. And if you've got this end stage damage called total villus atrophy, you got a problem. And you're diagnosed as celiac, they get your blood, they store it, and it goes into the celiac bank of blood samples. And so when the researchers buy the blood, they get the blood from the celiac bank of blood samples, and all those people have celiac disease, and it's total villus atrophy. But what if you have just partial villus atrophy? What if there's just the earlier damage that just hasn't gotten so severe yet? Or what if you just have the inflammation that is the mechanism that causes this damage in your intestines? How accurate is the transglutaminase blood test? It turns out that the transglutaminase blood test for partial damage that's not complete yet, or for the inflammation, is accurate about 3 out of 10 times, meaning 7 out of 10 times the doctor will get a test result back that says no problem with transglutaminase, and the doc says, no, you don't have celiac disease, you see. But wait a minute, doc, wait a minute, I just heard this lecture, and apparently there's research that says if they look at people with partial villus atrophy or with increased inflammation, the sensitivity and specificity of the test is down around 27 to 33%. So is this really a good test for me? I understand it's right on the money if I have total villus atrophy. And the, you know, this is language that's really awkward for some people. I don't know a way around it. Actually, I do.
Of course.
I've got a handout on my website that's available to everyone.
Good.
Called The Conundrum of Gluten Sensitivity, and you just take that handout to your doctor. It explains everything in detail so that they understand what kind of test to do.
THEDR.com. Yeah.
Right, thedr.com. So that's the transglutaminase. It's really accurate if you're at the end stage. If you're in the earlier stages, then it's wrong up to 7 out of 10 times with false negatives. But that's looking for celiac. That doesn't look for gluten sensitivity. So let's go back to our definition of gluten as a protein. Think of a protein like a pearl necklace. Hydrochloric acid that's made in your stomach undoes the clasp of the pearl necklace. Now you got a long string of pearls. Other enzymes in our body that come from your pancreas, they come from your gallbladder, they come from the good bacteria in the gut, their job is to clip the pearls off the pearl necklace so that they're really small. They're called amino acids. They're really small, and they go right through the cheesecloth and into your bloodstream. Then your body can use those amino acids. That's why amino acids are called the building blocks in the body. They're the building blocks. They help you build new tissue. And if you lay these amino acids down over here in this fashion, then you build bone. If you lay the amino acids down over here in a separate arrangement, you get muscle. Muscle cells are different than bone cells, but they're all amino acids. They're all made by amino acids. It's just how they're laid down. So your body needs these individual amino acids to build new tissue. That's the way it's supposed to work. But once again, we don't have the scissors to cut off the pearls of the pearl necklace for the toxic proteins of wheat, rye, and barley. So the best we can do are clumps of the pearl necklace. And those clumps of the pearl necklace cause the inflammation that I talked about in the Harvard study, causes the inflammation that tears the cheesecloth, but it heals. And it tears the cheesecloth, but it heals. And then one day it doesn't heal anymore. So you've got the inflammation. Now these clumps of food, these macromolecules, they're called peptides, get into the bloodstream and they wreak havoc wherever the weak link in your chain is. So that is the mechanism that occurs. So how do you test for that? Well, the test for gluten sensitivity that's done by every laboratory in the country is called alpha-gliadin, G-L-I-A-D-I-N, alpha-gliadin. Now, alpha-gliadin is a 33-pearl peptide. It's 33 amino acids long. So if these are supposed to be one amino acid, maybe two, and this is 33, you get a vision of how big this molecule is. And it gets in the bloodstream through the tears in the cheesecloth. And 50% of people will have elevated antibodies to alpha-gliadin. But the other 50% don't. But wait a minute. We know that that this is a sensitivity to gluten, like in celiac disease, how come these other celiacs don't have elevated antibodies to alpha-gliadin? It's because they're reacting to different clumps of the pearl necklace, not just that one clump. But every laboratory in the country looks at that one clump of the pearl necklace called alpha-gliadin. If it comes back positive, you got a problem. If it comes back negative, it doesn't mean you don't have a problem.
Mm-hmm.
It just means you don't have a problem with alpha-gliadin. And there's only one lab in the country that I know of, and I helped start this lab 5 years ago. I worked with them for a year beforehand and for 2 years afterwards, and then I disconnected myself a couple of years ago, and I have no financial interest in them whatsoever. So I can unabashedly say everyone that wants to check for a gluten sensitivity needs to do this test, because this test looks at 10 different peptides of gluten, not just one, and not just alpha-gliadin. It looks at alpha-gliadin, but it looks at 9 others. So you have much less chance of getting a false negative. You have a much better chance of identifying a problem if you have a problem when you do a more comprehensive test. And all of that is laid out in the handout, The Conundrum of Gluten Sensitivity, which we will make available to all of your listeners.
Great. That sounds awesome. So there seems like there's a lot of false negatives
right.
for gluten intolerance. You know, what do people say? What about a false positive? Like, what if I'm really not sensitive to gluten? Will the test, and the test shows up I am, does that ever happen?
Well, that's a really good question. You know, and no laboratory test is perfect.
Right.
What this lab did, Cyrex Labs, what they did is to make sure, because they knew that they were the new kid on the block and they're going to rock the boat quite a bit by coming out with these tests that no one else has ever done. They knew that. So what they do is every test is done twice. Every test, and they don't charge you extra for it. And if there's more than a 6% variation, I believe it's 6%, it might be 3%, but I think it's 6, more than a 6% variation between the two tests, which is within, well within the norm to occur, if there's more than 6% variation, they do the test again, no charge. And that means a third time they've done the test. And if it still comes back out of balance with the others, they throw the sample out and ask for a new sample. No extra charge. So they're doing their very best to stay on top of it. So I don't know what it means with Cyrex to have a false positive. I think a false positive means, well, I don't feel sick when I eat the food, so it's no problem for me.
Yeah.
Yes, it is a problem. It just hasn't made itself visible to you yet. You haven't developed a tumor in your eye that's visible. Or like my godmother died of liver cancer. For most of her life, she had mildly elevated liver enzymes. Her doctor always told her at her physicals, you have to stop drinking. And she never drank, but she had mildly elevated liver enzymes in her blood tests every year at her physical. And it turns out Mayo Clinic published a paper that showed mildly elevated liver enzymes may be the only marker of celiac disease in some people. They don't feel anything. It's just mildly elevated liver enzymes. Now, and that a year on a gluten-free diet, and you bring those people back to normal. Now, when you have mildly elevated liver enzymes are a measure of dead liver cells and how many cells are dying, and then your body makes new cells. So we lose cells every day. We make new cells every day. And there's a normal range for that, and that's your normal range for liver enzymes. But when you have mildly elevated liver enzymes, you're killing more cells than you're making. And so when that goes on day after day after week after month after year, like it did for my godmother, killing more cells than she was making, one day she had severe stomach pains, and they rushed her to the hospital to find out she had 4% of her liver left functioning. 4%, 96% of it had been killed off. Unbelievable, she never had any symptoms. Unbelievable. And she was a happy woman on no medication. She's 84 years old, no medications. But she had advanced liver cirrhosis, like she was a heavy alcoholic. And
I know.
It'll manifest wherever the weak link is in your chain.
It will. So let me ask you another question about testing, and this is something came up with recently with one of our clients. And we had suggested a gluten-free diet and, you know, started to do some, but she really wasn't convinced that she needed to go 100%, so she did the Entero Lab stool test. They test for IgA to anti-gliadin. So it could be, obviously, you can get a false negative, but if it's positive, it means that there's antibodies sitting there waiting to attack, sitting in your gut. So it came back positive, but she still wasn't convinced and mostly went off, but it wanted to still be able to eat it every now and then and tested, had the genes for it that would have the tendency. But then the Cyrex test came back 100% clean on both the array 3 and array 4, which is cross-reactive, and the full gluten panel. And so
right.
I'm completely puzzled. Like,
That's easy if you've read the literature on this one, and that's what I do. You know, I'm just kind of a geek, and so...
I trust you to have the answers for me, Tom.
You bet. Thanks for that. There's no question that the antibodies are elevated on the lining of the intestines, the inside lining of the intestines, 7 years before someone gets celiac disease, years and years before there's any other indicator. They are there on the surface of the inside of the intestines. There are a number of studies that have shown that, and there's no contention with that at all. So if you're doing a stool test, people ask me about stool tests all the time, and my response is always the same, and that is it depends on how you define credible. If you define credible that you can take it to your local hospital and say, hey, I'd like to include this test in our panel of tests that we offer, it's not credible at all because there haven't been any studies that have confirmed what one lab has shown to be the value of the test. And now the owner of that lab is a really good, high-integrity, well-trained gastroenterologist that just believes in his heart and soul of the importance of this, as I do. And he's written a couple of papers, and people have tried to reproduce that, and they just can't reproduce what he's done. So if you're a scientist and you look at hard evidence, there's no hard evidence. But if you define credible as, you know, it seems to be accurate because when people see that and they go completely gluten-free, they get better, then it's very credible. And I've used that stool analysis test for years before Cyrex came out. Because Cyrex is about what's in your bloodstream. Your bloodstream's the highway, and no human can digest gluten. We know that now. Those papers just came out this year. So clearly there's going to be elevated antibodies in the lining of the intestines for most people. And I don't know about in your practice, but in my practice, when I do the stool test, a lot of people, very high percentage, somewhere certainly above 60 to 70% of people were coming back positive. And for the vast majority of those people, when they go gluten-free, they just feel so much better and their symptoms go away.
Right. And I would say for me, in all the years I did it, I only had one person came back negative.
Yeah, exactly, because everyone has a problem with it. So the immune system in your gut, that's your first line of defense, is the mucosal immune system. It's going to react first. And so you're checking a different compartment there. You know, you're checking the compartment inside the gut, not inside the body. Remember, your gut is a tube from the mouth to the other end, and it's like a donut.
It's trying to keep it from getting in.
Right, and if you can stretch that donut out into one big long tube, 20 to 25 feet long, that's your intestines. So things go into the donut, into the hole of the donut, but they've got to go through the walls of the donut to get into the bloodstream. And that's why the cheesecloth is there, is to let the smaller molecules get through. But when you're exposed to gluten, every time you have a reaction that triggers the genes for intestinal permeability, tearing the cheesecloth.
So then it brings up the question, in someone like that where it's clearly there, she has a genetic tendency and it's clearly there in the gut, but it's not showing up on the Cyrex panel, would that say that she probably should stay away from it, but because all of us should stay away from it in general because of the transient intestinal permeability, but the occasional, would the occasional exposure be okay for someone like that or not?
That's really a good question, and you've positioned that question in such a way that I'm smiling because I've never answered it before in the way I'm going to have to answer it to you because your positioning was really good, and that is, it depends. It depends. Usually I'd say absolutely not. Absolutely not. You cannot have gluten because your immune system's fighting it. But in this case, the marker that I would use to tell me how seriously to take this is array number 5. The autoimmune.
That's what I was thinking too. I was exactly thinking
exactly
that
right.
To see if there's any antibodies to other parts of the body as a
exactly
result.
Right. So if you've activated the antibodies in your thyroid and you're killing off your thyroid, or like my godmother, it was her liver and she was killing off her liver. She didn't know it. She didn't feel bad. Or if you've got antibodies to your brain, I had 3 different antibodies elevated in my brain from a gluten sensitivity, and I felt fine. I was a triathlete and, you know, doing well when I did this test. I said, what?
Mm-hmm.
And this is a mistake, you know, and it wasn't. And so I had to clean, and you have to clean it up completely. But if you can't find any evidence of an immune system that's attacking self anywhere, there's no autoimmune mechanisms going on that you can find, and all they have is elevated antibodies in the gut, I would be awkward and saying to the patient, I'd feel awkward, but in terms of being scientific and not being fanatical, I would say, Mrs. Patient, I think, you know, the best of knowledge is probably okay if you have a little once in a while, but you don't want to cross the line and tear the gut and get these things getting into the bloodstream. So what does that mean? Well, it means you check yourself about every 6 months or every year to make sure you still don't have antibodies in your bloodstream. And as long as you do that, I guess it's okay once in a while, I guess. You know,
I don't want to say this just in case, but...
Exactly, exactly. You know, I've never answered this that question this way before. But, you know, that's a really good example you give of when might it be okay to have a little gluten once in a while. And
yeah,
I've always
said never.
Well,
that's the question that came up, and I wasn't expecting it, and I don't usually say it's okay because if you have a genetic tendency and you have the antibodies. But, again, going back to your original premise, nobody digests it, and it is going to cause transient damage. And you just have to be super, super, super vigilant and careful that you don't cross that line. And because it's an invisible, like it's not visible to our naked eye, and it may not be visible symptomatically, you could cross the line and be causing damage quite a bit, quite a while before the symptoms actually show. And
that's exactly right.
Dreadful,
you know, symptoms,
right?
That's exactly right. Symptoms are the last straw. They're not the first indicator of a problem. They're the last straw. And so by the time you feel bad, you got a problem, and it's substantial. So the concept is you want to nip it in the bud before it gets that bad. You know,
right.
So it's just a question of what level of health and vitality do you want in your life?
You really want, you know? Right.
Yeah.
And I would say to someone, and this is what I typically say, is if you're feeling perfectly fine, first of all, I'm not going to be talking to them unless I'm just casually at a cocktail party talking to them because they're not in my office talking to me about how they feel perfectly fine and want to feel even finer. So if you're feeling perfectly fine, your energy is perfectly fine, you have no gut symptoms, your memory's fine, your skin is fine, your joints are clean, you feel great. And this is your situation. Well, the occasional, so you don't push yourself over the edge, is not going to hurt you. But if you have any symptoms at all anywhere in your body and you've got some evidence that your body's reacting to this, then I would say I would be negligent if I didn't say my recommendation is to stay away from it just in case.
That's exactly right. I'd agree with that.
So let's go back to the brain, because we really want to tie this back into the brain, and then we'll wrap up. Symptoms like, you know, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, those are serious, and those antibodies that you had in your brain conceivably could have then down the road a bit led to
you
having those conditions, right?
Yep, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. There are so many ways that it can manifest. You know, there's a concept that's a little bit advanced for the general listeners, but it's really good to know. It's called cross-reactivity.
Yep.
And cross-reactivity is that when your immune system is fighting a particular food or a bug or a bacteria, if something comes around that looks similar, the immune system thinks it's still fighting the same food or bacteria, and so it keeps making antibodies. Even though you're not eating that food anymore, even though you're not eating gluten anymore, if you're taking in a food that your body thinks looks similar enough to gluten, you keep making the gluten antibodies, right?
Yeah.
And that's just a fact. And the reason I talk about that is because cross-reactivity is based on how many pearls of the pearl necklace that your immune system is fighting. Is it the 33 pearl piece, or is it the 12 pearl piece? How many pearls is your immune system fighting? What size molecule is it fighting? When it's fighting that molecule, let's say it's 33 amino acids long, and I'm going to say A, A, B, C, D. I'd have to say 33 letters, but I'm not going to do that. So let's just say A, A, B, C, D. So you have antibodies going around looking for A, A, B, C, D. The problem is that the blood vessels in your brain, the inside of the blood vessels where the blood's traveling and the antibodies are traveling in the bloodstream. Remember, your bloodstream's just a highway. There's no lanes of traffic. Everything's bouncing around in there. There's no lanes of traffic. And it's looking for A, A, B, C, D, and your antibodies fire these chemical bullets to destroy A, A, B, C, D when it sees it. That's how vaccinations work. You make antibodies to measles. You've got these antibodies going through your bloodstream looking for measles and shooting the measles bugs wherever they find it. So, A, A, B, C, D. These antibodies are going through your bloodstream. They're going through the brain right now in the blood vessels of the brain, and the wall of the blood vessel facing the inside of the blood vessel that the blood's going right past, the wall is made up of proteins and fats. And those proteins include A, A, B, C, D as part of the big protein structure. You know, there's hundreds and hundreds of amino acids or bricks on this brick wall, if you will. But A, A, B, C, D, they're the yellow bricks. And the antibodies to gluten will fight the yellow bricks that are in the wall of your blood vessel. And it attacks the blood vessel. And that's one of the mechanisms by which you can have brain damage and brain symptoms from a sensitivity to a food, commonly gluten, is because of cross-reactivity, that the tissue looks similar enough to the food that you're fighting. Under a microscope, it looks similar enough that the immune system is going to go after it, if that's the weak link in your chain.
Got it.
So with my godmother, it was her liver, and AABCD went after her liver. With this 3.5-year-old child, it was her eye, conjunctiva in her eye. In other patients, it's their joints, and they've got rheumatoid.
Their symptoms go away.
Or psoriasis, or attention deficit, because there's so much swelling in the brain, they can't think clearly. Attention deficit or autism. And for many of these people, they do better when they eliminate the food that their body is sensitive to and the immune system is fighting.
I love it. You have a great way of explaining things to make it real, real clear, that whole AABCD.
Thank you.
Cross-reactivity, it gets in the way. It's like a drive-by shooting, you know? The bullets are straying everywhere, and you just happen to get in the line of fire, and your blood vessels get in the line of fire, your joints get in the line of fire, and other parts get in the line of fire, and then, wow, you know, you create this problem. So it's like, I look at it, it's like, it ain't worth the risk.
That's a really good point.
Nothing tastes as good as healthy feels. So,
you know,
why bother?
Exactly. That's good. That's a bumper sticker. That's a really good bumper sticker. You know, when a plumber really takes pride in what he does, the plumbing in his house is going to be first class. You know, when a carpenter really takes pride in what he does, and it's not just a job, he makes sure that his house, if it's a new house or if he's remodeling the house, the carpentry is first class, right? And if you're a healthcare practitioner and you read these studies and you see these studies about all these different things, you go the extra mile to have your body function first class. To the average listener, this sounds almost like we're nutcases, because we're talking about so many different conditions that may be caused by gluten. But, you know, there's over 20,000 articles in the literature, and I've probably read maybe 1,200, 1,500 articles. I don't know them all by any means, but I've read a whole bunch of them in the last 15 years, and that's what I do all the time. And I got it. Said, wow, this is such a huge problem. If there's one thing that everyone could do in terms of modifying their lifestyle to really take care of themselves, is find out if you have a sensitivity to the most common food that everybody eats. And it's wheat. It's the most common food. You get toast for breakfast, bagels, sandwiches, pasta, croutons. You add flour into soups, flour into gravies. It's the most common food we're exposed to multiple times a day, every day.
Absolutely. And that's the reason people ask, well, why, you know, why wheat? Why wheat? Why wheat? It's, you know, people ate it years ago, but we didn't eat it 24/7, right? People wake up at, you know, midnight and go for bagels or go
Dr. Don Casarda is the go-to guy in the U.S. Department of Agriculture on wheat. And he says, you know, people ate more wheat in the 1870s and 1890s than they do today. And
really?
He showed the numbers. Yeah, it was really surprising. I was startled to see that. He said, so, you know, it's not that they're eating more wheat. Now, it's true. It's true that there is more gluten in the wheat, and more of this protein that's, because gluten means glue. It's sticky. So when your buns rise, they can hold their shape better with less flour, so they're lighter. It's true about all of that. But the reason, the really bottom line reason, and the studies have shown this, of why so many more people are getting this, and it's true they are, it's four times more than in the 1950s. That's 400% more than in the 1950s. And the reason why that's occurring is because of something called loss of oral tolerance. What that means is you cross the line. Somewhere you cross the line. And people are crossing the line earlier in their guts than ever before in history, across the board. Now, and for the listening audience, you don't know this, but this hopefully is a wake-up call in some ways with what I'm about to say, and that is that the World Health Organization rates the United States number 2 in terms of overall quality of health care out of 53 industrialized countries. Number 2, second from the bottom. and yet we spend more than any other country on health care, and we're ranked second from the bottom. Our infant mortality rate is second from the bottom, and many, many other markers are at the bottom or second or third from the bottom. So the overall rating is we're second from the worst in the world. And as of 7 years ago, Dr. Reed, I know you know this one, the New England Journal of Medicine published a paper that said for the first time in the history of the human civilization, human species, for the very first time, children have a shorter projected lifespan than their parents. They're going to get sick earlier, suffer earlier, get diagnosed with diseases earlier, and die earlier than their parents. And we're all walking around with our heads in the sand, doing exactly what everyone says we should do, listening to these silly commercials. Do you think it's okay to put commercials on the air for these drugs, and in the background the voice is saying, warning, this may not only cause cancers and cause you to lose a limb or go blind, this may kill you. And yet we look at these commercials, and we see all these happy people bouncing around, and we just tune out. We tune out because we want symptom relief. And you can't do that. I mean, we're killing ourselves off.
Right, absolutely. Well, that's why we're both passionate and do what we do and work tirelessly to get this information out there because, you know, we've got a big voices to be talking our voices against, you know, the pharmaceuticals, the drug companies, the Monsantos, who are just feeding the doctors with misinformation and then feeding it to the people, and people just want to hear what they want to hear. Oh, yeah, no worries. If I get cancer, you know, there's a lot of cancer research, and I'll just go to the hospital, and they'll do chemo and radiation, and I'll be fine. And we know that that's just a whole bunch of crock. And
I'll be fine. Where's my sticky bun?
Yeah, just give me, you know, and they feed it to them, right? Somebody was taking a picture in the office, like she was in the hospital with some relative for a chemotherapy treatment, and there's the people sitting in the waiting room with the bowl of candy that they're feeding them. So, you know, it's really got to change, and the only way it changes is if everybody takes charge of their own health and decides that it's worth doing the little, the work, because there's no pill. I wish I had it. You know, when somebody comes to see me and they talk and I'll do anything you tell me to do, but I'm not going to go gluten-free because I think that's a bunch of hooey, and even I'm looking at them going, they need to, I'll say, you know, thank you very much, but I think you need to find a different practitioner because I wish I had a magic wand that could undo the damage that you're doing and just say, oh, yeah, I have a pill for that, but I don't.
Yeah.
So I wish
good for
you luck.
Yeah, in my practice, what I've done many times is I make a recommendation, the patient says, no, I'm not going to do that, doc. I'm not going to do that test. I don't have a problem with gluten, or I don't want to know. I say, okay, hang on. And I write in the file, patient refuses the gluten test. And then I say, here, would you sign this, please? Well, why am I going to sign that? Because I believe it's a problem, and if 3 years from now you die, and your family subpoenas records to find out all the doctors that you saw and how come nobody caught this, I need it in the record that you refused to do what I asked you to do.
Oh, wow.
Well, no, oh, that's all right. Okay, I'll do it. Or some of them just sign it and maintain their belligerence. I don't believe in this gluten stuff. It doesn't matter what you believe.
Right.
Just read the science.
I don't believe in gravity.
Yes, right. Right. You know, I've got a really good I'm preparing a presentation I'm giving in a couple of weeks in Florida. And I've got this really good slide. I just really like it. And it's a cartoon of a dog that's on a psychiatrist's couch. And the psychiatrist is sitting next to him. And the dog's got a collar. It's one of those little collars, the radio collars for the invisible fence. And the psychiatrist is sitting on the couch and with a pen and paper, you know, and said, now, tell me once again about this imaginary fence that you say is out there. And that's the way it is with gluten sensitivity. It doesn't matter if you believe it or not. You don't have to believe it. You just have to ask your immune system, because your immune system is the armed forces in your body. It's the Army, Air Force,
yeah.
Marines, Coast Guard,
yeah.
Navy. It's there to protect you. So if you've called out the immune system, if it's on high alert, you got a problem.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter if you believe you have a problem or not. You got a problem.
Yeah.
Body
yeah.
language never lies. You just have to learn how to read body. You just have to ask the question. So I want to be very clear. I'm not saying that everyone needs to give up gluten. I'm not saying that. What I am saying is that everyone that has a concern about their health, if their health is not the level that they want it to be, those people need to be checked to see if they have a sensitivity to gluten. It doesn't matter what the symptoms are. Fatigue, anxiety, schizophrenia, tumors
right.
in the eye, Kaposi sarcoma, ALS, rheumatoid arthritis, psoriasis. It doesn't matter, because it can cause any symptom in your body depending on
right.
where the weak link is in your chain.
Absolutely. And just to be, I'm going to just be a little bit play devil's advocate with you here a little, but not everybody needs to get off of gluten completely. But based on what you said earlier, that everybody gets a transient, the activation of the intestinal permeability gene, and everybody has a transient leaky gut when they eat gluten, that everybody needs to significantly cut back on the amount and the frequency. Otherwise, at some point, they're going to cross the threshold.
That's a rational line of thought, very rational, based on science. That's a very rational way
mm-hmm.
of looking at it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if you got somebody who's perfectly healthy and you're talking to them at a cocktail party and go, look, here's the deal. You know, do you really want to find out 3 years from now that now you have, you know, an autoimmune disease affecting your brain? Do you really want to find out that you have rheumatoid arthritis? Just cut back on it so you give it, it'd be lovely to know what number of hours it takes before it heals itself again, right? So
yeah.
that you just go gentle with your body, and occasionally you go to a party and you have a roll, and then you don't do it again for a while. That would be the more rational approach for people who haven't already crossed the tolerance, who already don't have antibody activity going on and inflammatory processes going on. But for the rest who do, any kind of health challenge at all, I personally believe, and I think you feel that strongly about it, that either if you're not willing to pay the money to get the test, you just go off of it, or you pay the money, get the test, and find out.
You're absolutely right. That's a very rational approach. You know, I just I had that conversation with a new friend that I made. I was at a week-long training recently up in Canada, and I met this guy, and he was the founder of what turns out to be the largest data storage company in the U.S. And he started in his garage. It's one of those great stories, you know, and then sold it for hundreds of millions of dollars a few years ago. One of those kind of guys, just a really brilliant,
yeah.
brilliant guy. And he has psoriasis. And not bad, but he's got psoriasis. Not bad meaning it's not over his entire body, making his life miserable. But we talked about it. I said, you know, you should just do these tests, man. Well, why would I do that? I see the best docs in the world. They've never talked about this. And I said, so how do you feel about this, about your condition? Is it going away? Well, it's being managed. And do you think as you get older that you have as much strength as you do now? We all age. Do you think you're going to might have more of a problem in the future? Well, that's rational. I said, so do you want to find out what the mechanism is that's going on here? And so he did the test, and we talked this morning. I reviewed the test this morning, and what I want to say about that is that this particular guy is built like a Sherman tank. What that means, I said, do you have high pain tolerance? Yeah, I've got a real high pain tolerance. You're the kind of guy, you're not going to feel something until it takes you down. And that's the person that you hear of, your friend that didn't feel well, went for a physical, got diagnosed with cancer, and in 3 to 6 months they're dead because it's all over their body. It's all through their body. How do you have cancer all through your body and not feel it?
Not feel it.
And some
right.
people have a very, very high pain threshold, or they're just disconnected from how their body feels because they're eggheads. You know, they're in their head and they're
right.
helping the planet in so many wonderful ways, but they're not in their body. They don't feel
right.
it. So how you feel doesn't matter. You just have to be rational about this. And so in that example, it would be, all right, I have an autoimmune disease here, and this is rational, what Dr. O'Brien's talking about. I'm going to do these tests. And we found out this morning what it was, and a sensitivity to gluten. So we'll see what happens now in the future as he takes action on that.
Oh,
I'll give you one more example.
Wonderful. Oh, I love it.
I'll give you one more
hours.
Example. Do we have time for one more example?
Yes, we do.
Okay. Here's a fella who, 44 years old, his father died at 44 of a massive coronary. His two older brothers died in their early 40s of massive coronaries. And when his last brother died, he was in his late 20s. He went to a cardiologist and was put on a statin. He didn't need a statin, but to be safe and protective, he's on a statin. So he's 44 now, and he said, I heard about your test. I want to do your test. Comes in. He's the picture of health. He exercises very regularly. He's good muscle development, good tone, kind of a GQ-looking kind of guy. His diet is impeccable, no junk food ever, because he knows there's something in the family. And he sees his cardiologist every 3 months, and they do simple blood tests, and everything's fine. Cholesterol's good. He's exercising regularly, so he's got good endurance, looks really strong, Adonis-type body. Everything is great. He said, I heard about your test. I want to do your test. And this is array number 5, the test that looks for 24 different tissue antibodies, the autoimmune diseases.
Right.
So it comes back, and he's got all 3 antibodies to his heart, sky high.
Oh, boy.
Sky high. What that means is that his immune system is attacking his heart aggressively, causing inflammation in the heart. But he doesn't feel anything because every other aspect of his life, he's doing his best to take care of himself because he's scared. So he's exercising regularly, eating really good, doesn't feel a problem, looks good, completely missed by his cardiologists and his other doctors and everybody else because he feels great. So he said, why do I have this? I don't know. Let's find out. It turns out that he had 4 or 5 of the peptides to gluten elevated, and he had intestinal permeability. The classic mechanism in the development of these autoimmune diseases, put him on a gluten-free diet, gave him the nutrition to heal his gut, and in 6 months, the antibodies of the heart were down to normal.
Wow.
Just saved his life.
Saved his life.
I didn't do that. You know, I didn't do that. That's the work. That's the all these researchers and what they've done. And it was his work, going gluten-free, that made the world of difference for him. Most likely saved his life.
And his dad, right, could have saved his life, likely.
And his two brothers, right, because this was the last male in the family. If you have a sensitivity to gluten, it's genetic, and people don't know that. So if you have a family member diagnosed with celiac disease, there's a 20% likelihood you've got celiac. You're on the spectrum somewhere. So it's 1 out of 5 if you have a family member that's been diagnosed. In general, it's about 1 out of 100 in general. But depending on the group, in Finland, it's 1 out of 4. A couple other countries in Northern Europe, 1 out of 3, 1 out of 4.5. If you have a family member, it's 1 out of 5 that will have a sensitivity to gluten. I'm sorry, I said Finland, 1 out of 4. That's not right. It's 4% is 4 out of 100.
Okay.
Yeah, and in Europe, in the northern countries of Europe, it's 4%, 3%, 3.5%. So that's 3 out of 100, 4 out of 100. But if you have a family member, it's 1 out of 5. It's 20%.
Yeah.
So if you have a family member with a sensitivity to gluten, you just want to be checked. Just be checked, irrespective of how you feel, because you might be able to nip something in the bud before it destroys so much tissue that now you start getting symptoms.
Yeah, and I will just stick in there that they're getting checked. So like for a lot of people, it's really it's not cost effective. It's like $500 for the antibody test. So if that's the case, then the most inexpensive test is to just stop doing it.
Yes.
Just do the intervention. If you can't afford the test, do the intervention, because it's not going to hurt you to do the intervention. It can only help.
Right. And when most people do the intervention, they notice, oh, you know, I'm sleeping better, or I'm something better. I'm better.
Yes.
Now, but for guys like this guy with the heart antibodies, he would not have noticed a difference because he felt fine. And he was great across the board. So he really needs the test.
He knew it was life or death. See, I've never tested myself. I've been 100% gluten-free for except for one exposure that I know of, accidental, but for 7 or 8 years. And before that, I was mostly, you know the phrase, mostly gluten-free. But before that, I was mostly gluten-free. I've never tested myself. I don't need to test myself. I'm convinced. You've convinced me, you know, your research is really what threw me over the edge when I started looking at that years ago, and I'm like, holy cow, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, look at my family. I don't need to waste my money to do it a test. I'm just not doing it, right? But not everybody's as, you know, just dedicated that way, and if you're not, then do the test, right?
Exactly right. That's a really good way of holding that whole thought process. That's the right way of doing it. The last thing I want to say is for all of your healthcare practitioners out there, you really need to dial down on this. This is you think you know about gluten, and I say this to doctors all the time. You think you know about gluten? All right, answer this question for me. How come children diagnosed with celiac disease have a threefold increased risk of dying 5 years out and more, earlier mortality than children not diagnosed with celiac disease, with or without a gluten-free diet? These kids have a shorter lifespan. How come? Or how come an adult that gets diagnosed with celiac disease has a 3.86-fold increased risk of death in the first year after diagnosis? You diagnose someone with celiac disease, nothing else changes, you've diagnosed them, and they have almost a fourfold increased risk of death in the first year after diagnosis. How come? And if you don't know the answers to those types of questions, you really don't know how to protect your patients. And you need to be a certified gluten practitioner. So it's the CGPs, and many of Dr. Rita's clients have gone through the program, and thank you for that endorsement on that. It's the CGPs that understand this. They understand why that is and what to do about it. And this training is, it'll change your life, I promise you. There's so much information in there, and it's an online training program. You learn at your own pace. You go through a section. Some of the sections are an hour. Some are 2 hours long. Then you take the test. Pass the test, move on to the next section. Don't pass the test, go back and review. I don't need you to memorize all this stuff. I just need you to be aware of it. And then when you do, after you pass the test and you become certified as a gluten practitioner, you're listed on our site. And we get hits every day on our website from all over the world of people looking for, who can I see about this? Oh, my God, this is wonderful, terrible information. Who can I see in my area that knows about this? And I send you PowerPoints so you can go out in the community and give lectures on this. And I send you research articles. And I highlight the bullet points in the research articles. Doctors don't have time to read all the articles. Just read these bullet points. These are the important things to read about. So for any of your healthcare practitioners that are interested in this, the site is certifiedglutenpractitioner.com, certifiedglutenpractitioner.com, and you enter the code CGP500 in the coupon code, and you'll find that there's a discount for you there, specifically for Dr. Rita's people listening in here today. So please consider that. I think every healthcare practitioner needs to know this information because you save lives. You actually save lives when you do this, when you really know what you're doing.
Thank you so much. Thanks for all that, for all your time, for all your insights, for your passion and dedication in getting the message out there and in helping us, you know, the world of dedicated health practitioners to learn it too. Because it's when the more that we can reach the practitioners that are out there in the trenches, the more people are going to start to hear it when they start to hear it from their doctors, their nurse practitioners, et cetera. So I just applaud the work you're doing. I really just respect you so much, and just you're wonderful. If you want to come and hear Dr. O'Brien speak in person, we have a conference coming up in October, here in end of October, beginning of November, here in Austin, and he's going to be speaking on the first day of the thing on Friday, going into more detail for health practitioners on the brain-gut connection and with gluten, and just an amazing presentation. And just to be in the same room with him and hear his energy and ask questions will be awesome. And that's at shineconferenceevent.com, shineconferenceevent.com. We'd love to have you there. We've got a whole spectrum of weekend activities for just for practitioners. Certainly you're welcome if you're not a practitioner. If you're a savvy consumer who wants to be your own doctor, you're welcome to come as well, because it's for you as well. So thank you again. This has been Dr. Tom O'Brien. The website is thedr.com. Don't forget to download the Conundrum article that he has there. And then if you're a practitioner, it's certifiedglutenpractitioner.com. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. And the code you use is CGP500. That's the code for you folks to use. And if I may, I'd like to give just a little plug for those on the East Coast. I'm going to be giving a free general public talk on the evening of Friday, October the 9th in Atlanta. And I'll be lecturing in Atlanta that weekend. But we're doing a general public talk that night. It'll be a couple of hours, really kind of putting the whole picture together for people. And you can find out more about that on my website, thedr.com.
Perfect. Thank you again so much. Thank you all for listening. I know that it's been great. And check out the resources on thedoctor.com, thedr.com, and hopefully you join us in Austin, live and in person. And
yes, I'd really look forward to that. I look forward to seeing you, Dr. Rita. And so thank you so much for the opportunity to be with you today.
Thank you. Bye-bye now. This is Dr. Rita Marie, and we're on Vibrant Health Solutions Radio Show. And I appreciate you being here, and join us again next week. And we will have, in the meantime, have a wonderful, vibrant day. Bye-bye now.